Surf with me.
Thank you, Gary. Yeah. Welcome, everyone, to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thanks very much for tuning in to my first show of February. February 3rd means that we've got two great authors who I'm going to introduce you to in this next hour of programming. The first is Abraham Verghese. He's a professor of medicine at Stanford University and the author of a number of books, his most recent, a best-selling novel, Cutting for Stone. Abraham Verghese will be the featured speaker at part of the California Lecture Series, an event that takes place a week from tomorrow, Thursday, February 11th at 7:30 p.m. in Sacramento, California at the Crest Theater. You might be familiar with the great speakers, authors, including John Updike, for instance, John Irving, who have appeared at the Crest Theater as part of the California Lectures Series. Well, a week from tomorrow, it will be Abraham Verghese, professor at Stanford. We will be joined by him on the live line in just a moment. And then in the second half of the show, we will enjoy an interview with Wendy Barker. She is a poet based in Arizona, who will be here this coming weekend for a reading of her work at the Avid Reader in the city of Davis. Two great authors and an hour to spend with them here on KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis as part of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Welcome back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS 90.3 FM Davis. Very much appreciate you tuning in this afternoon. I'd like to remind you that there is a poetry reading this evening at 8 o'clock at Bistro 33. Tim Call and Robert Grossklaus, both of whom have been on this radio show, will be reading from their work at 8 o'clock tonight, a new time, 8 o'clock rather than 9, at Bistro 33, 226 F Street in the city of Davis. My first guest this afternoon is Dr. Abraham Verghese. Abraham Verghese is the author of three best-selling books, Cutting for Stone, his first novel, now in paperback, and two nonfiction books, My Own Country and The Tennis Partner, which were both critically acclaimed. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and The New Yorker. He lives in Palo Alto, California, and is a tenured professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, where he is also senior associate chair for the theory and practice of medicine. He's been able to use fiction to explore the theories and practices of doctors, and I'm very pleased that he can join me this afternoon to talk about his new book, Cutting for Stone, now in paperback, and about his appearance in Sacramento next Thursday, February the 11th at 7:30 as part of the California Lecture Series at the Crest Theater. Abraham Verghese, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you so much, Andy. Pleasure to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you here, sir. And I'm very pleased about the circumstances that have brought you here. Your latest book, a novel, is now in paperback, Cutting for Stone. And I'd say that probably most of your colleagues in the School of Medicine also do not have MFAs in creative writing or best-selling novels. So I'm wondering how it was that you have brought these two elements of your life together to form a sane whole as you try to juggle all these responsibilities and interests.
Yeah, I think the word sane whole is key. I actually resist the notion that I'm this binary being and one half is the writing part and one half is the medical part. I really view my first love as truly being a love of medicine, a love of the romance and passion of this ancient craft. And the writing to me emanates from that love, even if it is fiction, even if it's nonfiction. I think it's very much an extension of that love for the profession. So I also think in terms of my other colleagues here, they are equally busy and prolific in research arenas and so on. And I always argue, well, this is my research equivalent, my writing and my literary work. It's really the same sort of creative effort, but in this direction.
I'm interested to hear you say that, because I know you've said in other interviews that it's important for medical professionals and scientists to think as well with the right side of their brain, especially when working with patients, as well as to be excellent analysts of diseases and symptoms. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that, why that's important to you as a doctor, and you feel it should be important for other medical professionals as well.
Yeah, I think that's forever. You know, medicine has always been art and science. It really has been clear that even though there's a great scientific basis to what we do, it's very much a human interaction that is important. And actually, William Carlos Williams, one of your heroes, I would imagine.
That's true.
Used to say that, you know, when you see a patient, you're not looking at a liver or a heart or a kidney. You're looking at one guy or one gal who's in distress and handling it in their unique way. And you as a physician, your most important tool, William Carlos Williams would say, was to, quote, fall back on your sense of self. And the older I get in medicine, or the more years I spend in medicine, the more I'm conscious of you know, the role of one's own persona as a therapeutic instrument. And not to overstate this, I mean, when you need an antibiotic and when you need a surgery, you need those two things. But, you know, so much of the dissatisfaction, I think, in American medicine from the patient's point of view stems from a sense of the doctor being this technological being who doesn't really get interested in their humanity and their humanness. And so when I sort of preach about, you know, students needing to read novels and read poetry, I do think it's that keeping the right side of our brain alive that allows us, as William Carlos Williams would have put it, to fall back on our sense of self and then to have a better understanding of who we are in order to use that instrument effectively.
Wonderful. If you're just joining us, my guest is Abraham Verghese. He's the author of a number of best-selling books. His most recent is Cutting for Stone. It's a novel, and he will be speaking this coming Thursday, a week from tomorrow, on February 11th, as part of the ongoing California lecture series that happened at the Crest Theater in downtown Sacramento. If you want to find out more, I invite you to head over to californialectures.org to find out more about my guest and an opportunity to see him speak. And that being said, at the conclusion of our conversation, I'll have some a few sets of tickets to give away for those of you who would like to see Abraham Verghese in person. I'm wondering if you could share with us a particular example when you were working either with a medical student or with a patient where you might have called upon some of the lessons that you learned in Iowa as a MFA student, which to a certain extent is exercising the imagination, but also exercising empathy to a great extent. I'm wondering if there's an example that comes to mind where those skills came in particularly handy for you.
Well, you know, I think even before Iowa, but certainly after Iowa, I had a great appreciation for the importance of story in medicine. You know, as I frequently tell my students, story is all about, you know, conflict, crisis, and resolution. And the fact is that, or another way to put it, is story is about the three Ds. Drama equals desire plus danger. And for most of our patients in the day-to-day lives, you know, going to the grocery store, picking up the kids from soccer practice, there isn't necessarily story there. There is no danger or drama. But I think every time a patient comes to see us, there is the potential for danger. There's a potential that this is the visit where, you know, we might hear something that significantly impacts our longevity and our quality of life. And so there's always a great sense of suspense in the visit. And I've found that it's helpful to remind students and, remind all of us in medicine that what's routine for us is far from routine for the patient, that story is very much operative. I think the other way that you know, I've called on Iowa is, for example, when I'm really trying to get students to appreciate what it's like to be in a patient's shoes, even though it's almost impossible to do that completely, I will often point them to a story that illustrates some aspect of this. For example, end of life. You know, what does it feel like to get the news that your life is ending, and to how do you convey the sense of isolation you feel from your loved ones? A great example is Tolstoy's story, you know, The Death of Ivan Illich. It is just an amazing means of allowing students to experience that sense of isolation. Or, you know, from time to time as physicians, you will have a patient who will bring out the worst in you, and you will have this great desire to, you know, to cut short their life, even though hopefully you'll never, ever act out on it. And in that context, I often will point them to William Carlos Williams' story, The Use of Force.
Right, I was thinking about
that. Yeah. And, you know, it actually puts voice and gives expression to a sentiment that can be universal. And again, it's important that you recognize it. It's important that you don't deny that you have these sentiments from time to time, rather than that you learn to know yourself well enough to know that you can have these feelings and don't have to act out on them and understand that they can happen.
Well, those are great examples, and I'm always gratified when listeners have an opportunity to write down a mini syllabus of suggested stories or poems at the end of a conversation. So those are two good ones. I think the William Carlos Williams book, is it called The Doctor's Stories?
I think that came from The Doctor's Story, yeah. It's widely anthologized, but I think that's where it began.
And I remember when I taught that to students in an introduction to literature class years ago, that they were quite shocked by how much the speaker kind of inhabited the anger, almost as much anger as his young patient was displaying in her unwillingness to be examined, especially the unwillingness to open her mouth and
look
at her throat. That's wonderful. Well, Abraham Verghese is my guest this afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. He's written a book called Cutting for Stone that is recently released in paperback. It was a national bestseller and widely praised. The New Yorker called it beautiful and amazing. The San Francisco Chronicle called it a masterpiece. And John Irving had kind things to say about you as well. And I just wanted to share a little bit of that with listeners, that Abraham Verghese is a doctor and a writer is now already established. The miracle of this novel is how organically the two are entwined. I've not read a novel where in medicine the practice of it is made as germane to the storytelling process, to the overall narrative, as the author manages to make it happen here. And at the end of this review, he said that that Cutting for Stone is a remarkable achievement. And I bet that when you think about your intellectual and novelistic heroes, you might count John Irving among them. That must have been really gratifying to read that review of his.
Oh, that was really wonderful. I mean, he's been a friend and someone whose method and purpose and seriousness about writing has been a wonderful thing to emulate. And he has never given a blurb in 20 years or so, and for him to give a blurb to my book is just, I was blown away when he told me that. So I'm enormously grateful to him at many levels, partly for this blurb, but even more so for his friendship over some 15 to 20 years now. I should also share with you, Andy, that just found out today that the book is debuting at number 11 on the New York Times bestseller list, which I found out today. And so it's very gratifying. I think the word of mouth around the book has really brought it to this point, and I couldn't be more humbled and grateful for that.
Wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your novel, Cutting for Stone, which is out in paperback now. It's a substantive work, both in page numbers, in its international scope, and as was just mentioned in that quick blurb, part of the blurb that I read from John Irving, in its focus on medicine. What were some of the narrative challenges that you set before yourself when you were constructing your novel, Cutting for Stone?
Well, I actually began this novel with a singular image of a very beautiful Indian nun. And I pictured her in a mission hospital in Africa giving birth to twins. And I must confess, that's all I had. And I pushed that forward following that voice and that feel. And, speaking of John Irving, John, I think, is just wonderful at knowing his whole story before he starts and, really having it all pretty much figured out in his head and so he can focus on the writing. And what John would say about someone like me who makes it up as you go along, he would say that I'm not a writer, that I'm just an ordinary liar making it up as I go along.
Right.
But I do think that there really are two schools of thought on this, and I certainly followed this voice and kept pushing it forward, and there were many dead ends, many hundreds of pages and months in a certain direction, only to find that's not the story and to have to retreat. And I think there came a point in the book where I actually felt, and my editor felt, that there were too many possibilities. There was just so much that could happen. And my editor, Robin Desser, a wonderful woman, she said, Abraham, we have to have you just figure out what's going to happen now, because otherwise you're just going to be bedeviled by choices. And so I actually sat down with her and we mapped out the rest of the book, and it was so liberating to know what was going to happen. And I came back to write feeling just I could focus on the writing. But I must tell you, Andy, even then there were enormous surprises in terms of things that would happen that I had not anticipated. And I think that's the great joy of writing, is that on the one hand it's a left brain, planned experience, but on the other hand it is utterly mysterious. You poets would speak of the muse, and I think it's that mystery of something that kicks in for which you have to be sitting at the chair and you have to be trying. It doesn't, to me at least, it doesn't happen walking by the riverside. It does happen when you're making an effort to write, and suddenly you tap into something utterly mysterious. So I think what I'll take away from the book more than anything else is the lesson or lessons of, how to write a novel and what to do and what not to do, and the great mystery and joy that accompanies all those decisions.
With the challenges that you overcame to, say, complete medical school and residencies and other trainings. And then I know that you've done a lot of work with AIDS populations as well. That I'm wondering how you might compare that, as you were just speaking, to the sort of discipline that's needed to write a novel. The way you just described it with making all these right brain discoveries, that it sounds almost like a delightful joyride to see where it will go next, and then finally to have that gratification of a map being laid out in front of you, even if it was under duress at first. So can you talk about the different sorts of discipline
sure.
that were necessary?
Although I don't want to overstate it. I think things are always more delightful in retrospect when you look at them,
right.
you know, through the rearview mirror, if you will. But I think that, you know, there is a truism there that, you know, I think so much of life and medicine is simply about putting one foot forward and then the other. You know, I think it was Antoine Saint-Exupéry who said, every journey begins with a single step,
right.
and it's always the same step. So, you know, I think that I'm beginning to appreciate now, at this stage in my career, how necessary and important all the drudgery of the early years of studying medicine were. And, you know, there were moments that were sheer drudgery, both in terms of learning and in terms of tasks. And yet the accumulation of those has given me sort of a certain level of skill that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And so I'm very grateful for that. And I think with writing, it's the same thing. I mean, the moments of insight are not happening every day, far from it. And I think, you know, John Irving would be a great example of someone for whom, who I think you have to admire his stamina more than anything else. I think he would say that stamina is the greatest attribute a writer can have. And I completely understand that when he says it, because if you don't have the stamina to do this, you know, day after day, while every weekend picking up the paper and seeing, well, so-and-so has another book out and so-and-so has another book out.
Right.
You know, if you can just keep at it, one day there is a reward. And I think the more times you do that, the more you sense that, you know, you will achieve your goal. And when I say reward, by the way, I must clarify, I don't mean sales and I don't mean the financial reward. I mean just the satisfaction that this thing that you cooked up in such isolation, imagining the moment when a reader will engage it, is now, you know, in fact now inhabiting the reader's mind. It's become this cooperative, collaborative venture between you and the reader. You provide the words, they now provide their imagination. That is the true joy of being a writer, I would say.
Wonderful. Well, if you've just joined us, my guest is Abraham Verghese. His most recent book is Cutting for Stone. It was a national bestseller in hardback, according to the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, as well as the Boston Globe and Denver Post. And now it has just premiered at number 11 on the fiction bestseller list. USA Today calls it a winner filled with mystical scenes and deeply felt characters. Verghese is something of a magician as a novelist. You spoke of the pleasure and gratification of finishing a novel and using it finally as an opportunity to connect to an audience and kind of break through the isolation that's necessary to work on such a project. I'm wondering if at the close of our interview, if you could give us a little bit more of a preview. What sort of pleasures do you think await and discoveries await the reader of Cutting for Stone?
Well, you know, I might speak generically in terms of the kinds of things that I like reading in a novel. I've always, from the time I was a youngish boy, I've always loved these novels where in the second or third page you have suddenly forgotten who you are and where you are.
Right.
And all the chores that await you and the homework that's due. And instead, you are transported to a world that is completely unfamiliar to you and yet seems as though you were born there. And you now inhabit this world for several generations and, you know, perhaps the span of a century. And when it's all over, it's Tuesday. And you're back in your own world and it's just Tuesday. And yet you come back with all this wisdom of a lifetime and all this sense of having lived vicariously in another lifetime. That sense of transport and that sense of, I think, edification is, I think, what every writer strives for in a novel. And I hope with this novel you will be transported to an exotic land, to Ethiopia, where part of the novel takes place. I hope with this novel that the truism about geography being destiny will become very clear. I mean, you know, it is true. Geography is destiny. If you happen to be born in one continent, it completely changes the way your life would play out. And I hope that it would give the reader a sense of the great drama and passion and romance that informs medicine. I mean, for all its dark side, its dangerous nature, the way it can suck you in, it can also redeem you. And I hope a reader experiences all these things with my book and finishes and finds out it's just Tuesday and their whole life's ahead of them, but they had a nice interlude in my world for a couple of days.
Excellent. I'll remind folks that it is a National Public Radio Best Book Club Book of the Year, and you'll have an opportunity to see my guest, Dr. Abraham Verghese, speak about his most recent publication, Cutting for Stone, at the California Lecture Series segment on Thursday, February 11th, that's at 7:30 p.m., in Sacramento at the Crest Theater, 1013 K Street in Sacramento. To find out more, you can go to californialectures.org, and as soon as we hang up, I will also have some tickets to give away to this fascinating event. Abraham Verghese, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you about your work as a doctor and as a writer. Perhaps the next time I have you on the show, we can also talk about more about your work as a teacher, which is a first love of mine. And anyone so thoughtful about all these topics, I'm sure, has something to share on that account as well.
I'd love to. Have me back. I'd love to talk about that and poetry, so I'd love it.
Excellent. We'll put those two on our list. Thank you so much, Dr. Verghese, for your time, and I look forward to your event a week from tomorrow at the Crest Theater in downtown Sacramento.
Thank you very much, Andy. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS, 90.3 FM, Davis. If you would like an opportunity to have two free tickets to see Abraham Verghese speak at the Crest Theater a week from tomorrow as part of the California Lecture Series, then I invite you to call me here at the studio. This is Dr. Andy telling you that the number here is 530-752-2777. That's 530-752-2777. You can also reach us at 530-754-KDVS. I've got tickets to give away, so give me a call.
This hour of programming is brought to you courtesy of the Yolo County Federal Credit Union. The Yolo County Federal Credit Union is a nonprofit financial cooperative with locations throughout Yolo County. The Yolo County Federal Credit Union offers a wide range of financial services and can be reached by phone at 530-668-2700 or online at yolofcu.org.
I still have tickets to give away. perhaps to you if you're the next caller. It's 530-752-2777 or 530-754-KDVS. Abraham Verghese will be speaking at the Crest Theater a week from tomorrow night. The tickets are not free, but they will be if you call here and claim the tickets I have for you. 530-752-2777. Stick around, for in the second half hour, I'm preparing for you an interview with none other than Wendy Barker. Here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. The law firm of Palmer, Kazanjian, Wohl, Hodson asks us to work together to combat short supplies at our blood banks. In today's world, transfusions are not always available, delaying needed operations and endangering lives. Remember, the greatest gift you can give is the gift of life. This important message is a courtesy of the law firm of Palmer, Kazanjian, Wohl, Hodson in Sacramento. Further information about their firm is available online at pkwhlaw.com. They're on the air because they care about the people in this community. Welcome back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thanks very much to John Coltrane, whose album Blue Train is providing the bumper music this afternoon, something to interrupt our conversations with great writers. I have a couple tickets left for Abraham Verghese if you'd like them. I won't be able to answer your phone calls now, but you can email me at aojones@gmail.com. That's aojones@gmail.com. I'd be glad to provide you with those tickets to that event a week from tomorrow at the Crest Theater if you are the first person to email me requesting them. My next guest this afternoon on this KDBS radio show is Wendy Barker. Wendy Barker's novel and prose poems, Nothing Between Us, The Berkeley Years, was runner-up for the Del Sol Prize and was published by Del Sol Press in 2009. Earlier full-length collections of poetry include Poems from Paradise from WordTech Press, Ways of Whiteness from Wings Press, Let the Ice Speak from Ithaca House Press, and Winter Chickens from Kelowna Publishing Company. Barker has also published three chapbooks, Things of the Weather, Between Frames, and Eve Remembers. A selection of poems accompanied her by autobiographical essays. Poems Progress appeared in 2002, and a collection of translations from the Bengali of India's Nobel Prize-winning poet Rabindranath Tagore. Final Poems received the Soret Deal Fraser Award from the Texas Institute of Letters. Over 200 of her individual poems and translations have appeared in journals, including ones that you've heard of, like Poetry, the Georgia Review, the Gettysburg Review, the Partisan Review, where I worked for a while back in the 1980s, and her essays have appeared in such magazines as Poets and Writers and Southwest Review. She's taught at a great number of universities, and has read her poetry at universities, bookstores, festivals, and conferences in the U.S., Europe, and in India. Her work is frequently anthologized. As a scholar, she's the author of Lunacy of Light, Emily Dickinson and the Experience of Metaphor, as well as co-editor with a former professor of mine, Sandra Gilbert, of The House is Made of Poetry, The Art of Ruth Stone, which was a 1996 publication of Southern Illinois University Press. She's recipient of an NEA fellowship, a Rockefeller residency, fellowship in Bellagio, as well as a great number of other awards in poetry. She's also been a Fulbright senior lecturer in Bulgaria. I'd like to also mention that she's an Aggie, having done work here in the city of Davis years ago. I'm very pleased to welcome her back virtually. Wendy Barker, that was quite an introduction. Welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you, Andy. Yes, that was quite an introduction. Thank you for that.
Absolutely. I wanted to remind folks right off the bat that you'll be reading this coming Sunday afternoon, February 7th, at 5 o'clock at the Avid Reader on 2nd Street here in the city of Davis. You'll be reading mostly from Nothing Between Us, The Berkeley Years. And I'm sure it'll be an interesting sort of homecoming to see how much Davis has changed since you first arrived here many years ago.
I'm very eager to come back to Davis. I have very fond memories of Davis. Received my PhD in 81, and Sandra, of course, was my dissertation director and my mentor and dear friend and continues to be. So I'm really looking forward to coming back.
Absolutely. Well, before we dive into your poetry, let's talk a little bit about the years that you were here, the late 70s and up until 1981.
Uh-huh.
Who were some of the other faculty members who, in addition to Sandra Gilbert, who I'd be very pleased to talk about further, but who were some of the other faculty members who were helpful to you or an inspiration to you? As you were working on your PhD in English here in the late 70s and early 80s?
There were a number of them, Andy. Dave Robertson,
mm-hmm.
Actually some people, I'm trying to come up with a couple of names of people who, I forget.
David Robertson, but, although he retired last year, he's the current chair of the English department.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my.
And still very active, not only with his own writing, but with his photography and kind of mashup artwork
using that's good to hear.
Photoshop and,
uh-huh.
and print in a variety of media.
Uh-huh. Well, Joanne Fite-Deal and Jim Woodruff were both readers for my dissertation and were extremely helpful. Elliot Gilbert, who, of course, we lost years ago.
Right.
Bob Hopkins.
Yeah.
And I'm blanking out. It's been so long. But I think those are really the people who helped most.
Those, you know, that's a great number of names. Sandra and Joanne, along with Alan Williamson, were the three folks on my dissertation committee.
Oh, see, I left just as Alan was coming. That was my loss.
Well, you may have a chance to interact with him during your visit this coming Sunday back to the city of Davis, where you'll be reading at the Avid Reader. Tell us more about your book, Nothing Between Us, The Berkeley Years. They're primarily prose poems, is that right?
They are prose poems, yes. I have been writing prose poems for some time, fascinated by the genre, reading a lot of them. And when I began, I started writing these poems in 94. And I wrote most of the individual poems between 94 and 98. It's been that long ago. The book has seen a lot of revisions and a lot of changes since. But the book is based on experiences that I had in the late 60s when I moved to Berkeley from Phoenix. In 1968, which was the year that the Berkeley schools integrated all of their schools, the entire school district. It was one of the first school districts in the country to voluntarily do so.
Right.
And I heard Abraham, who incidentally we miss so much in San Antonio. He was here with us for a long time. But I heard him say earlier that geography is destiny.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't agree more. And I would add, in terms of speaking about Nothing Between Us, that I think destiny also has a lot to do with the era that we inhabit, what the age we are, the decade we hit.
Right.
And I hit the 60s in my very early 20s and moved to Berkeley in 68. And although I had taught English for 2 years in Scottsdale, Arizona, and although I was very excited to be part of this actually nationwide, nationally famous integration project about which everyone was very excited, I found myself in a world that was very, very alien and frightening. I had talked to Kill a Mockingbird. I had seen Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I was not prejudiced. I was, you know, I was a good liberal young woman, and I was going to eradicate racism. And I arrived at this all ninth grade school that was at that time in the almost all African American neighborhood of Berkeley, in what people call the Flats. And it was an overwhelming experience. I had loved teaching, and when I arrived at West Campus in 1968, I was floored. I didn't know what to do. As I mentioned in the very first poem, the narrator of the novel erases everything she put on the board before. Nothing that she had done before made sense.
Right.
So it was an experience for me of really learning, an enormous learning experience.
Wonderful. Well, it seems to me that if you're going to be in Berkeley in the 1960s, your own 20s would be a good age to experience that, where you can kind of grow into maturity at a time when Berkeley itself, and especially UC Berkeley students, were trying to do the same, but in a time of great tumult and constant conflict.
Yes, yes, yes. Great tumult and constant conflict, yes. And I was young enough. I mean, as we said in those years, you didn't trust anybody over 30. I was well under 30, and yet I was in charge of 180 kids every day. So I was sort of between. And I hope one of the things that the book communicates to people through these prose poems, these are little vignettes, if you will, I hope it communicates a sense of the complexity of those times and the complexity of the racial issues that were at stake at that time and still are in many ways. It's a sad book, I think. It's I think a lot of what the book deals with is the attempt to try to make something work along with the great difficulties of that.
Interesting. Well, the book that we're talking about is Nothing Between Us, The Berkeley Years. It's a book of prose poems by my guest Wendy Barker, who will be reading at the Avid Reader in the city of Davis this coming Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock. I know that over at Poetry Night at Bistro 33, which might have been the City Hall building when you lived here, Wendy, that they've moved their poetry series from 9 p.m. to 8 p.m., and there'll be a reading tonight by two Sacramento poets at 8 p.m. But 5 p.m. is even more reasonable, and people should therefore formulate fewer excuses, I think, not to attend this event at the Avid Reader this coming Sunday afternoon at 5. Wendy, we're going to take a quick break to hear a public service announcement, and then when we return, I hope that you'll read one of your prose poems from your book, Nothing Between Us.
Thanks. I'd love to, Andy.
Great. We'll be right back with more of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
The Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the Linux computer operating system and other open source products as an alternative to expensive, proprietary, and monopolistic software. LUGOD meets in Davis on the first Tuesday and third Monday of each month. For more information, visit LUGOD's website at lugod.org or contact Bill Kendrick at 530-759-1019. Or via email at root@lugod.org.
This is Dr. Andy with an important message that you can now recycle your television set or computer monitor at the Yolo County Central Landfill for free. For more information about the Electronic Waste Recycling Act, visit www.erecycle.org. My guest this afternoon is Wendy Barker, and she's got a new book of poetry out, prose poems, called Nothing Between Us, The Berkeley Years. Came out last year from Del Sol Press. And she'll be reading from this book this coming Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Avid Reader on 2nd Street in the city of Davis, across the street from the Varsity Theater, whose second screen opens this coming Friday, if I remember correctly. So movie lovers are in for a treat, as are all of you who love good poetry. I've asked Wendy if she'd be willing to read one of the prose poems from her latest book. Which one did you pick out?
I think, Andy, I'd like to read the one called Remedial Reading.
All right.
Remedial Reading. The smallest classroom in the ninth grade school. Yellow walls and the ceiling seemed too high. Boxes lined up in bright colors on the tables, each a different level. This class for retards? This a toonie class? The kids swaggered and straggled through the door, unwilling to be seen here. Laminated cards, one at a time. Second, third grade skills for 14-year-olds, mostly boys. I'd been assigned to help the reading teacher, her thick gray hair bunched and slipping along with hairpins and combs. Ruth organized field trips, took her own beat-up station wagon. Once she drove us up the coast to the great blue heron's nesting grounds. We walked up and up until we could look straight down into the tops of the trees. She showed us how to spot the saucers of nests resting in the branches. I never got the kids to move beyond a level or two. Nobody stayed on task. Once I was pronouncing vowels with Lester Sims, light-skinned, freckled, a skinny little dude. O, okra, Oakland, Coke, and O, butter, supper, dove. His eyes shone. He was standing beside me. Doves, he said. We can talk about birds. Sure, I said. I told him about the finches I was raising at home in as big a cage as I could afford. Man, why didn't you say you wanted us to talk about birds? And he was out the door. Before the bell rang for the next class, he was back. I was putting cards away in their boxes, red-tipped ones in the red box, brown and brown, folding the lids closed. You like pigeons? He grinned. I do, I said. He unzipped his jacket. I don't know how many wings flapped out from him, ruffled my hair, and fluttered all through that yellow room, a sound only feathers can make, as Lester told me every one of their names.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you feel when you reread that poem that it was specific to a particular time and place, as the title of your book suggests, or is there something universal in the sort of surprise that's revealed at the end?
Maybe both, Andy. That's a good question. Maybe both. That's one of the incidents in the book that really is hardly fictionalized.
Right.
It's very much that experience actually happened, not just to the narrator, but also to me. It's one of those teaching experiences one never forgets. But yet I also think it probably has universal applications as a reminder of how much we teachers always learn from our students. I always feel, even now, or especially now, I learn far more from the students than they do from me. And that poem, I think, is an example of that sort of thing.
It's one of the ongoing rewards of being a teacher, isn't
it? That's right. That's right.
Now, and it's interesting to me that you've published many more books of poetry than you have of criticism. I'm moving in that direction in my own scholarly and productive work as well. And I'm wondering how the labor is necessary to write a dissertation as you move towards a PhD in English. How to what extent they've been helpful to you with your own work as a poet, and helpful to you in all of the books of poetry that you've written since earning that PhD?
That's another good question. I think the research skills are one... I think the research skills help enormously with writing poetry. I do a lot of research in connection with many of my poems, not all of them,
mm-hmm.
but that curiosity, that desire to just find information and make connections that we have as scholars, I think also does us very well as creative writers. And yet the process is very, very different. I don't know how it is for you, but it's a very, very different kind of almost waking up in the morning doing writing scholarship and writing poetry. This sounds somewhat cliched, but I think there's a linearity that's involved in writing scholarship that's
right.
not as much in writing poetry. And one sort of does have to follow that thread, whereas with poems, things can sort of go all over the place and bizarre connections can happen. And yet they both require a wonderful thing of many, many, many wonderful things that Sandra Gilbert used to say to when we were her students. And one of them, and I'll quote it, one of them that I quote now to my students is writing, she didn't say it this way, I'm saying it this way, writing is always discipline. And what she said was, it's the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair.
Right.
And whatever kind of writing it is, it's always the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair.
And what you say, though, about being receptive to kind of nonlinear structures, and this might be itself a cliche, but often we think of poets being out and about and practicing a kind of receptivity to what they encounter. Often they'll encounter what's most important to a poem when they're far away from the study.
Yes, yes, yes. It's not yes. That's a very interesting distinction. Much of the material that feeds poems is not found in other texts, literary texts.
Right.
It's found in texts outside of rooms and outside of libraries and outside of books or even Google or even online. Yeah.
The way that, and I was discussing this with my students in one of my writing classes this quarter, the way that Helen Venler talks about the structure of poetry, I've had to draw up on the board for students to understand. But she talks about a kind of radial structure and a sort of centripetal force towards the center, whereby a good poem might reflect an increasing understanding of a single topic or concern or response to a moment of dis-ease. And therefore, it makes sense that it would not be structured in a linear way, because it's necessary that you keep coming back to it in the way that Chaucer once said that the tongue returns to the sore tooth, that we keep coming back to a particular topic that bothers or concerns us or provides us with some sort of dis-ease, and maybe a poem can help us better understand that concern.
Yes, yes. And sometimes just make surprising connections. Just,
right.
You know, bizarre, amazing connections. Yeah.
Well, I think, Wendy, that we should definitely schedule another conversation, because I feel like we've just started one, even though we're coming up to the end of the hour. You'll be reading mostly from your most recent book of poetry this coming Sunday, right?
Yes, I will.
And I want to remind folks that it's called, excuse me for one moment, Nothing Between Us, The Berkeley Years. And what do you think would be the easiest way if someone wanted to pick up a copy of this book? One would be to come see you at the Avid Reader this coming Sunday at 5 o'clock. But other than that, where else could one find Nothing Between Us, The Berkeley Years?
I know the Avid Reader has copies. It's also available on Amazon.
Excellent. Well, Wendy Barker, this has been a pleasure. I look forward to our next conversation when we can theorize publicly some more about our love of poetry and trying to figure it out, and also hear some more samples of your work. We all got just a taste there, which I very much enjoyed, and I look forward to enjoying some more this coming Sunday afternoon.
Andy, thank you so much. I enjoyed it, too.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Have a good evening.
You, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour. There's a poetry reading tonight that I want you to know about. It starts at 8 o'clock at Bistro 33. I'll have details in a moment. Stick around here on KDVS, 90.3 FM, Davis.
Easy. Everyone would do it. It takes a special person to join the National MS Society's Bike Tours to Fight MS. If you like a challenge and want to have some fun for a good cause, call 1-800-FIGHT-MS.
I'd like to thank my guests this afternoon on Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour. They include Abraham Verghese, the distinguished professor of Medicine at Stanford University, who's come out with a gorgeous book. I've got a paperback copy in my hand here called Cutting for Stone. Abraham Verghese will be reading this coming Thursday, no, a week from tomorrow, February 11th at 7:30 at the Crest Theater as part of the California Lectures series. If you don't know Abraham Verghese and you'd like a chance to find out more about him and his work, he's a fascinating character, as I hope you heard, then I invite you to drop me an email. My name is Dr. Andy Jones, and I'm at aojones@gmail.com, aojones@gmail.com. The first few folks who send me an email starting at 5 o'clock this afternoon requesting tickets, requesting to be added to the will call list, will have that wish be granted. So drop me an email at aojones@gmail.com if you can make it to California Lectures at the Crest Theater on K Street a week from tomorrow, February 11th. I'd also like to thank the delightful Wendy Barker, who we just heard. She'll be reading this coming Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Avid Reader on 2nd Street here in the city of Davis, on 2nd Street between, I believe, E and F Streets. Yes, that's correct. Sunday, February 7th at 5 p.m., the Avid Reader on 2nd Street. Thanks very much to you as well for listening to this show. Perhaps I'll see you in but 2 hours when, at 8 p.m. tonight, none other than Tim Call and Robert Grossklaus will be reading from their work. Tim Call has a new book out. Many of you know him as vice president of the Sacramento Poetry Center. He's also a professor at Sac City University. And he's the author of the poetry collection Possessing Yourself. This is from WordTech Press, a 2009 publication. His poems have appeared in a great number of journals, including Prairie Schooner, American Letters, Commentary, Berkeley Poetry Review, and a number of other journals. He's also a translator. Robert Grossklaus will be reading with him. Last time he came on the show, he was talking about Polymer Grove Press, which is the publisher of books by A.D. Winans, B.L. Kennedy, and Jane Crown. I've also had those folks on my show. Maybe not yet A.D. Winans. I'll have to do something about that. Robert Grossklaus's poetry has been published in a great number of places. He's also a rock and roll musician in the band Litany. He and his wife live in Roseville, California. But tonight, at 8 o'clock, Tim Call and Robert Grossklaus will be taking the stage at a new time at Bistro 33's Poetry Night. I encourage you to check that out if you are so interested. You can also Google Tim Call and Robert Grossklaus and find out more on the World Wide Web. Stick around because we've got some great music coming up in the 6 o'clock hour, which I've already started bleeding into with my John Coltrane and my babbling on about poetry. And also, I'll be back in a week with a discussion, I believe, about theater here on your home for interesting talk about politics, science, astronomy, and on Wednesday afternoons at 5 o'clock, poetry and technology. And I believe tomorrow, Radio Parallax will cover the death of the great J.D. Salinger. So much variety, so much depth, so much of what you've come to